We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we're looking at the Omega Factor episode, Saint Anthony's Fire. A woman goes a bit crazy in the night, or maybe she's a bit frisky. It's hard to tell, but then she kills her husband with a knife. So I guess it's a bit crazy. The next day, Tom, who's been staying with Anne, reads in the newspaper that this couple have died. Turns out they're old friends of his. He wants to investigate. Martindale is firmly against it. But when Martindale forbids it, that convinces Tom he absolutely has to defy him and go do it.
Because Tom is two.
Yes. I should note at that point that Martindale seemed to know a little more about this than he should have. Whether or not Tom picked up on that, I don't know. Tom has to go to an island, a small island that used to have a sort of hippie, psychic, farming commune on it that these two people ran, but has now been taken over by a Swiss multinational organization. They're conducting research into making better plants through an unspecified technique.
Talking to them.
I think that was part of it, yeah. The town is a little bit strange in that sort of rural, sort of Wicker Man community kind of way. But Tom does find a blonde woman very much to his liking, despite her having a boyfriend. But she seems to find Tom to her liking, so that's all good. Martindale is given orders to send Anne to try to fetch Tom back. He doesn't want to do that, but he does. On the island, Tom has a psychic flash, experiencing the death, and realizing that it's not as reported, that it was some sort of crime of violence. People try to kill them. And I'm just going to leave it there. I didn't write up the recap, so I'm winging it on that one, I have to admit. That's sorry, folks. You'll have to watch the episode. It is available in the United States and Great Britain on DVD, so you know, go out and find out. But they don't get killed in the end. I'll break that much.
Spoilers.
Well, we'll be back next time with the next episode where Tom's not in it. Oh, wait. So St. Anthony's Fire, a real thing, not St. Elmo's Fire, which is honestly what I was thinking throughout the entire episode when I saw the title. I'm thinking, oh, they're talking about that electrical discharge on the masts of ships, St. Elmo's Fire. And it wasn't until they got to the end and they announced that it was ergot poisoning, which has previously been called St. Elmo's Fire, that the whole thing struck me. I don't know if I had thought of it.
You were thinking because it's an island, then they're bound to get on a ship, and then there's bound to be some St. Elmo's Fire.
Well, I figured it was like aura photography or, you know, the whole St. Elmo's.
It was, yes, it was a surprising twist, the link to the title.
Yeah, I just had something else in mind throughout the whole thing because I was thinking of St. Elmo's Fire and not St. Anthony's Fire. And I thought, well, it must have something to do with the episode. So therefore, there's going to be some sort of aura or static power or something. I figured that's what they were using on the plants. I figured that was, you know, maybe they found out that was some sort of a psychic thing and that they were using it to project to make the plants grow or something to justify Tom being here from the psychic research outfit. Just anything, but to have it turn out to be, frankly, a relatively obscure but real derivative of a poison, naturally occurring poison in rye and other grains that was causing people to go nuts and violent was kind of a surprise for me.
Well, I think they probably had a bit of a tough time coming up with a title for this one, in fairness. I'm not sure I could come up with anything better.
There was a whole lot of sort of back and forth nothing going on in the episode. And that's not a criticism. I enjoyed the episode, but at somewhere about three quarters of the way through the episode, I did realize it's like there's a whole lot of we don't know what's going on here, and I don't feel like I've gotten a clue along the way. Does that make any sense? I don't feel like Tom learned anything until the doctor actually sat him down and told him at the end.
Yes, yes.
So as an investigative journalist, not on his top form today, really.
Well, the man sat him down and explained it in the end, so, you know.
True, true. I guess that's the just hang around the bar until somebody finally spills the beans, which does seem to be Tom's M.O.
Seems like a good approach to me. That's what I'd do if I was an investigative journalist.
Well, let's start at the beginning. So, Tom, Anne's apartment. What was going on there?
I wasn't quite sure.
He's not dressed.
Because
she is, right? He's sleeping in. How did you sleep? I got lonely. Would imply he was in a different room. And we know she has multiple rooms. Yes.
Yes.
But, was he there?
That's the odd thing, because obviously he's, you know, from everything we've seen previously, he's nearby. So there's no particular reason why he couldn't have gone back to his own bed rather than taking her spare. But
right. Unless they've just been drinking a lot, but then they're in Edinburgh, they probably walk. And
that was my assumption, but because we've seen him leave, I think, you know, late at night to go into the quotes office. I mean, I've no idea how far these things are apart, but it felt like what we were getting was some kind of effort to show a level of intimacy, albeit celibate. But it wasn't really quite clear, as you say, why was he sleeping there rather than going back to his own bed? I don't know.
Yeah, and I think, I think we've taken a step up again in the relationship between the two, because Anne is definitely showing signs of jealousy later in the episode. Those two really confuse the heck out of me, to be fair. I mean, you talk about Sam and Diane on Cheers over the years, but this is, one episode she's on for it and he isn't, the next episode he is and she isn't, and there is no pattern that I can see whatsoever in this. I don't see this as a lead over from the last episode, where he screwed up again and she basically kicked him out.
I don't know. I think there's not so much a pattern as there's a reaction, and the reaction is she discovered she doesn't like him hanging around with the blonde on the island. So
that could be too. That could be. I don't know about you. Again, we could be talking about the 70s, but the blonde on the island comes in basically arm in arm with a man, effectively, and
yes.
and Tom doesn't have the slightest compunctions about flirting with her.
Ah, yes.
You know what
well,
I mean?
Yeah, I mean, yes, could be the 70s, could just be Tom, really.
I don't know anybody who has that kind of personality in real life. You see them on TV, and maybe they probably do exist in real life.
Gambit in The Avengers.
Yeah, maybe. I would have thought Gambit might have operated with a little bit more decorum, if that's the case. But
I think not.
You know, I could see Tom is a jerk. I mean, he's regularly a jerk to Martindale. He's regularly a jerk to people. I can kind of see what's like, well, you know, if I can get her away from you, then, you know, you're not holding on. So that's okay. She was the standout on the island, wasn't she? She's like the only blonde, the only, really only one of two or three women.
It's what we're talking about here are the constraints of budget. I think.
Yeah. Oh,
really? Yeah. The scene in the bar where the police come in and start trying to break up the kind of mass hysteria thing that's going on. You have the constable. And he comes up and he doesn't say a word. He just gestures. And he's right up in front of the camera. And to me, that just says we didn't have the budget for another speaking extra.
They did have a lot of extras, though.
That was what I took from that scene. But I think, you know, I think they had to... They spent the money on bodies. They couldn't pay for people who had lines. They couldn't afford it.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. And not to mention that, they had Terry and the Pirates, so they had costumes there, too.
Oh, my word. Terry and the Pilots. God, can't tell you how relieved I was when... They were about to play and it all hell broke loose. Phew.
I was dreading it.
Can that ever have been fashionable?
I was dreading it. I thought, oh no, please tell me we're not going to have a musical number that they have to kill time with a song. And then I would be thinking, oh, it's probably some local Edinburgh group that they want to get some exposure. And then the production team's like, eh, nah, nah, nah. Like, no. And they just bought... down anyways.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't object to it if the music is good. I do quite like the Avengers episodes with Venus Smith, where we get a musical number in the episode because it's good. You know, she's a good singer. The Dave Lee boys are good musicians. That's okay.
You didn't think Terry and the Pirates were going to be good?
Terry and the Pirates, it's just their general appearance didn't hold much promise.
It was the 60s. They did look like a 60s band, not a 70s band.
Yeah. It was kind of early 60s and a bit eager. You know, if they wanted to go 70s, they should have had punk band or something. Mind you, this is a remote Scottish island, isn't it? So
yeah,
perhaps they're not quite bang up to the minute there.
That could be. So
the time it takes you to send an LP out there, probably a decade or so out of date.
Yeah, and it's windy too, so you have to have music that just has a really loud volume. You can't have anything subtle when you're playing. You've got to pick your stuff well for those little islands. Anyway, Martindale. Let's talk Martindale. Who does?
Oh
not
well,
have-
yes, because if we're talking about fashion, the extreme other end. Phew, his tie is fantastic.
Was he wearing a tie? I guess he
was. Yeah. No, I liked his tie. I didn't like his temper, but I did like his tie.
Huh. I honestly don't see people's ties unless they're hideous. that's so 1950s for t- anyway. So are we... I mentioned last time, I think it was last time, and now I'm kind of confused what order we watched these in, but I think it was last time that I mentioned that they were really signposting that Martindale seems to be in with Omega.
I'm not sure. I think I mentioned last time. I'm not sure. And in this one...
Well, it could be a red herring.
Well, I think what we've got from the last couple of episodes is that Martindale has an agenda, and from this one... I definitely got a really strong sense that he knows a lot more than he's letting on. And, you know, he knows a lot more than we do. But at the same time, he seems to be a bit stuck in the middle. So it's like he knows what's going on the island. He already knows.
Right.
He knew at the beginning he couldn't stop Tom going. He probably didn't care about Tom going. But he didn't want Anne to be in danger. And he knew if he sent her there... that she would be. So in a way, he is trying to protect them, or at least Anne, a little bit. So there's still some of the good guy there. But well, I didn't get a strong sense that it was Scott Erskine on the other end of the phone. So I think he's talking to someone who has clout and knows a lot.
Well, that's a good question. So, one, with regards to sending Tom... I thought he was doing a fair attempt at convincing Tom not to go till he just, you know, bollocks it up by saying, don't go. Because
I'm not sure.
That's Tom.
You're the one who's previously complained that Tom is an employee of Department 7 and doesn't behave like it.
I agree.
The man is his boss. If he tells him he's not going,
he shouldn't go.
You know, or at the very least, he can tell him, no, he's not. Granted leave. I mean,
well, yeah, he did say
Tom says I'll do it at my own expense. Oh, that's very generous. Not spending the department's expenses budget that you have no authorization over.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. And so, I mean, there's so many levels that you can look at what Martindale is doing. It's like, don't waste your time on it. But again, you're right. He says things that make it sound like, you know, those aren't mistakes in the script. We're supposed to think that Martindale knows more about this, that he knew it was a drowning, quote unquote, a drowning, when that wasn't in the newspaper. And so he knows what's going on. So if he thinks Anne's in danger, which she turns out she was, then he would have to think that Tom would be in danger. And he did seem to try to stop Tom from going. But is that because he doesn't want Tom to screw it up? Or is that because he doesn't want Tom to get killed? So there's still that ambiguity there.
Yes.
With Anne, I think it was more obvious that he was concerned about her well-being. Although you'd still think that with the work he's doing, Tom is his star boy. For his agenda to continue, he'd really want to keep reins on him. So, I don't know. You have to think that the black phone is Scott Erskine, I think. Well, why have two phones? He's got two phones. Yeah. He's got a black phone. He's got a brown phone. He uses a brown phone for everything else. But when he looks at that black phone, it's like, you know, it's like the president of the United States looking over at the red phone and going, there's the Russians. It's like, you know,
internal and external. So which phone was he speaking on, and which phone did he then pick up? Because I didn't notice.
He did talk internally on the brown phone, and he was, whenever somebody was giving him orders, he was on the black phone.
Right.
And he would look at the black phone kind of like as a surrogate for somebody. But
if it's if it's internal and external, and Scott Erskine might or might not be in the building,
well,
he could come.
Not,
he could come in on either phone.
Fair enough. I'm not too common with internal, external, separate phone systems, but I suppose in 1970 Scotland that could have been a thing. But
I've no idea. I don't know why he's got two phones. But I'm only going on a hunch that he wasn't speaking to Scott Erskine. I don't think that there's anything concrete there. You know, you can pile up the evidence, but there's no smoking gun, no damning proof that it was or wasn't Scott Erskine.
And for all we know, Martindale could be working a separate agenda to try to destroy Omega.
Yeah.
I agree, but they definitely are not giving, they are giving clues to the audience that should make you think that it's that, you know, he is suspicious in his nature. And he wears an identical ring to the people from Omega, except it doesn't have the symbol on it. He's had that pinky ring, that black signet ring, I guess you would call it.
Well, that may just be the props department saving a bit of money, mightn't it?
Could be. It could be. I think, you know, at some point he's going to pop the top off that and the symbol's going to be underneath it. It's going to be his, his Spectre ring. But again, it makes me think it's very hard to look at the 1970s and say, okay, here's a guy who, by accounts of people I've heard, wears very nice ties. And I think he is probably wearing a fairly well-cut tailored suit, as you would expect from a prominent physician. So would that person, that age, that era, be wearing a pinky ring? It's not really something that would cross my mind. It's more of a specialty piece, but I don't know what would lead you to that position, to be wearing such a thing. But just odd that seems to be consistent with what everybody else is wearing when they're one of the bad guys. So, psychic powers. Tom actually uses them in this episode. Twice. That's amazing. He goes to the house of the murder.
Yeah,
which he doesn't know is a murder. And he sees the murder. He experiences the murder. He falls down the coal chute, I think. Is that
what we're... He's pushed down it.
Was he pushed down it?
Yeah, not down the chute, but into the cellar.
Well, so, okay. When the woman is going crazy and she kills her husband, and when she backs away, she disturbs the rug, and it appears for a moment that they show us a shot of a closed trap door. Did you get that?
I mean, didn't spot it.
It didn't make any sense to me at the time, but I saw that and I go, why did they show us that? So later on, Tom, I thought Tom walked into another room, and then I'm not sure. Did he get hit? Was he pitched forward?
Yeah.
And then the next thing he wakes up and the blonde is looking after him. Okay, what's that all about? Okay, I don't know. But there was the comments about him falling down, who left the trap door open on the coal chute, and I'm like, oh, trap door, coal chute. Maybe we were supposed to see that the coal chute was closed. Maybe that's what they were showing it for us at the beginning, that it was closed, and so somebody must have
opened it. Yeah, could be.
Okay, I can take that. They didn't do a very good job of killing him, if that was their goal.
Well, I'm not sure that was the goal.
Do you think he stumbled across somebody, or somebody was there with intent to do him harm?
I think somebody might have been there with intent to make sure that he didn't discover anything.
Okay. So he's got to go to the doctor. The doctor gives him some ointment. The blonde gives him the ointment. a rub down with the ointment, seemingly not necessarily where his wounds are. I'm not sure where that was going. Any of that. The whole thing with the woman, was she trying to throw him off?
Yeah.
Throughout, maybe get him to leave, because I'm thinking that's not the way to get him to leave. I could just spend the rest of my vacation here. I'm having fun, you know. My boss is very sympathetic. I can just tell him I'm going to take a few more days, and we'll be fine with that. we have the mysterious Mr. Is it Kellner? Kellner? Kepler?
I don't know. Like that.
I didn't write it down.
Neither did I.
It's Mr. K.
Yes.
They talk a lot about him, but he only puts in two brief appearances. Once at the bar when there's a big brouhaha, and once at the end when he's just going to kill him. I thought that structure was weird in the story. This is a lot of, well, as we're talking about him, maybe you can get to see him, and then it's really kind of anticlimactic. Yeah, it's just a strange episode. It's just a strange episode.
I think one big thing about this is there is a kind of a style of story that others have done, which is about going to an island or an isolated community where there is a mystery. And I can think of a number of episodes of The Avengers like this. You know, I'm thinking of...
I believe that's what you say. Yeah.
Town of No Return, for example, or the Eagle's Nest. Or this is probably pretty recently after The Wicker Man was released.
That would be my guess, right? Yeah.
So I think...
Hey, she was supposed to be Britt Eklund.
I think there could be an element of that. I can't believe it's not deliberate to kind of play up that idea, because it's supposed to be this kind of special isolated community. And they kept mentioning Findhorn, which I actually visited only a couple of years after.
Is it an actual place?
Film. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It'd be on the northeast coast. So I think in a way they must have been looking for filler for this episode, and they were, and there was, oh, we'll do an island story, you know, we'll do that one where you go to a closed community where everyone is keeping the secret. Murdersville in The Avengers being, mm-hmm. you know, another kind of example of the genre. And, you know,
well, if you're going to go to Scotland, you might as well.
Yes, it suits it, and it's not a bad fit for the series. But on the other hand, as these things go, it's certainly not the best I've seen that story done. You know, it's not The Wicker Man, put it that way.
That's correct. And it is, well, I mean, it's so all over the place. So we have the original premise that the couple who were killed had run this experimental plant thing that involved mm-hmm. talking to the plants and involved emotional response of plants, and which you could kind of make it's frequently tied in with the psychic plant thing, and I think we got that implied in this a couple of times, because as Tom explained to Martindale, you know, first it started out, then they had some great results, and then kind of it became the loonies came, basically, yes. Is what he said.
Yeah.
And
the new age hippies descend.
Right. And, okay, in a way, that feels like a Unit 7 thing. I mean, it sort of ties in with this thing. Obviously, Martindale's not the slightest bit interested, but it could be because he's a crook and knows all about it anyway, or it could be because he's... actually the hero of the series, and he's going to save the day with his duplicitous and suspicious ways. When they go to the island and the Scott Swiss, or Swiss Scott, is it a coincidence that Scott is in the name? Is that Swiss Scott as in Switzerland, Scotland, or is that Swiss Scott as in Switzerland, Scott Erskine? Or is it just... they can't think of imaginative names on the show.
I have no idea.
I didn't know if that was supposed to be a clue or tip off or something. Maybe this is a separate institute being run by Scott Erskine. But they're going on about replacing all the talking and the psychic with electronics.
Yes, because he sold out.
And are we supposed to take from that perhaps psychic phenomena is, in fact, a real measurable scientific thing that could be turned into some sort of an electronic process? Because that's kind of where I thought they were going then, is, whoa, this might be a way to make electronic psychic powers. But it turns out it's really...
Well, about electronic psychic powers, they're talking about the commercialization of something. If we're to imagine this world in which we have, you know... sensitives like Crane and all of the stuff around Drexel and his telekinetic powers and so on, all of that is focused on these ideas of essentially defensive capabilities and the government developing these things. And the idea here, I think, is looking at the commercialization of some of these things. In a small way, in that you've got some research of who knows what quality in this area, and then you've got a company recognizing that there could be, you know, assuming they're in the agricultural business and seeing the potential for it, investing in it for commercial reasons. So there's no reason why it should have anything to do with Department 7 in the sense of not necessarily having a defence application or anything that's interesting to the government. But on the other hand, it's the same field, which is kind of why it's an Omega Factor episode. It's not like Tom's chums have just been offed a random mugger or something.
If we take the psychic element out and move towards commercialization, then...
They're commercially exploiting the psychic element.
What's up with creating a plant species that just makes people into suggestible, let's call them zombies, but docile and suggestible?
Well, it's either a cover. Well, it is a cover, but it's either a cover for some rogue outfit, possibly connected to whoever Drexel's boss is, or it's a cover for some government research, which is another reason why Martindale might know about it. I don't think we can know that yet.
Well, it just seems like an odd, not a logical extension of their research. Let's put it that way. If you're into developing a way to, psychic or not, to increase crop yields for commercialization, it's a strange detour towards ergot research into mind control.
But that was a cover. They weren't interested. Surely they weren't actually interested in it.
In the mind control?
No, in the
commercialization of the plants?
The agricultural application of... psychic plant growth or whatever it was. That
Well, okay,
that wasn't
so
that really.
Is it a coincidence that that they used that island? So, well, there's a farm. Let's just buy them out and use that as a cover. Is that? I mean, it feels like we're going from psychic to not psychic to a completely different psychic thing. Or
I don't see where the not psychic comes. I mean, it's all about psychic, isn't it?
I'm not sure. Isn't the ergot
albeit
just
somewhat
to
far
mind
out
control?
A quasi scientific piece of research? Then you're looking at commercialization, but which you know would still be the application of the research to a commercial situation, but actually turns out to be cover for something much more nefarious, but it's still exploiting the same psychic discovery or whatever you want to call
so
it.
I wasn't clear that it was exploiting the psychic discovery at all. The ergot research is just he just said that's just we've done some stuff with the ergot and made it into a slightly different drug. That's just sort of ordinary mind control research. And then I'll throw
you mean
out
it's
the,
not with, psychic.
Exactly. I didn't get the only thing that I got out of that was when Tom tried to, at the end, use his hero psychic powers for a change and make the guy stop.
Well, I didn't get that because what you'd be presumably saying is that the drug simply makes them suggestible.
Well, that's what Kepler's, or whatever his name was, Kepler, Kexler, Kiefer, Mr. K. We'll go with Mr. K. It was unclear to me in watching through. It's like, okay, I wasn't expecting this turn. It's just drug control.
I thought it was making them more receptive to psychic suggestion. So yes, suggestible, but
you could draw that from the fact that Tom is successful. I agree that was the one piece to it that then I go, oh, well, okay, maybe that's what he meant by suggestible. But I just didn't feel like it hung together very logically. And of course, Tom starts throwing around Omega really early in the episode. Really early in the episode.
He's got a bee in his bonnet now.
He does. He says, everything must be them. I did not get anything up to the point where he first threw that name around that would make you think it was that organization, other than he just literally is obsessed with it at this stage of the game. So, I don't know. I would say, I don't think this episode exactly works for me. I like the fact that Tom actually had a psychic-y thingy,
Don't get too technical here.
Don't get technical here. And he had a little fit. And he did the psychic thing, which kind of seems like his whole purpose in being in the show. And then at the end, he was able to use it for once in an actual positive way, positive for him anyway, kind of shows he's developing. Because we haven't seen any of that throughout the course of the show.
He's in a desperate situation. He discovers he can do something that he didn't perhaps realize he was capable of.
And all the work he's been, quote-unquote work, he's been doing when he's at Unit 7, which, as far as I can tell, the work he does is to sit around, come in late, complain, and go off and do whatever he wants, whenever he wants it, to the consternation of his boss.
Someone's
got to
do it.
And there's apart from the very first episode where they put some tests on him, or the second episode where they put some tests on him, really have not seen them work with him. Haven't seen him work with his powers. We haven't seen him do anything. It's entirely reactive throughout even the first part here where he has the fit. Entirely reactive. He doesn't appear to be snooping around looking for psychic clues. He's just overwhelmed by them when he walks across the spot of the murder. Mm-hmm. And I find that very strange about this show as a series as a whole. For something that is, predicated on Tom being the psychic, he's not very.
I like that. I definitely like that. I don't want them to rush into Tom having all these kind of special powers or whatever. It's a bit like Firefly in a way. In the sense of
the girl Rivers,
how should we put it? Her what she's capable of or what she's sensitive to is really there's clear there's something, and you know that it's something quite profound and important enough for people to be really interested in capturing her, but it's not certainly at the beginning, and it's revealed very, very slowly. It's not obvious what exactly that is, and I think that's a very effective way of doing it, because if you reveal too much too soon, you've got to top that. You've got to, you know, if he were able to throw plates around the room in episode two, then you know, by episode eight, he's going to be like the master in the End of Time, firing thunderbolts to jump around building sites.
I don't exactly disagree, but so in Firefly, River's character is not really it's more of an ensemble. It's more of a primary. She's more of a secondary character, I would say.
Sure, but the principle's the same.
It is, except we are following his narrative, not Unit 7's narrative, not... yes, I don't want him to have those powers up front and then have to use them every week to solve the crime, although that's not necessarily always a wrong thing, but...
Wouldn't be as interesting.
We haven't shown any... We haven't... Since the setup was... You come to Unit 7 because it turns out you're a powerful psychic. There has been absolutely nothing made of that in several episodes.
No, I agree. I agree with that. But I think we discussed that before. My feeling is that all you need is for a scene to start with Anne meeting Tom at the end of an experimental session where he's been staring at a wall for 3 hours or something.
That would have helped.
I mean, we don't need to see all of this stuff happening. We just need a kind of vague suggestion that it's going on in the background. But for goodness sake,
yes,
let's leave it there. Let's not have Tom becoming a kind of pseudo superhero.
I don't disagree. It's just that the way the episodes are edited and written and cut, there is no suggestion of that whatsoever.
Yeah.
Tom goes into the office just to argue with Martindale and leave. Week after week.
I think that's a fair criticism, but I'm not at all. I mean, I think it's fine that, you know, at this point I have slightly lost count, but where are we? Episode seven. I think.
Yeah.
That Tom actually does do a bit of the kind of superhero stuff, because clearly no one is going to, you know, once he's been arrested and Kellerman's trapped him in the room on an island where everyone's against him or under mind control, then frankly no one is going to save him, and it's a legitimate kind of get out. But I don't want to find him doing it next week.
Yeah, it's just kind of not, well, I suppose maybe foreshadowed a bit, but kind of, it's just kind of hit and miss. It's just kind of hit and miss in the way they handle it, and and again, we're on episode seven, so I don't know whether they had dreams of having series two or whether this show is going to come to a crashing solid end. I really don't know.
Well, I guess we're going to find out
in three episodes. Let's talk a little bit about Anne. So we've talked about the fact that she's letting Tom stay over at the house as a, air quotes, house guest, and cooking him breakfast, which, you know, I guess if somebody was staying at your house as a house guest, that actually would be what you would probably do no matter what the circumstances. So I guess that's fine. She gets very jealous, or seemingly gets fairly jealous, in the seeing that blonde woman, mm-hmm. which I guess in a way she has grounds to do so, because the woman's obviously putting the moves on Tom, who doesn't seem to mind, and, you know. But apart from being there for the jealousy angle, did she add anything to this story?
Well, not a lot, really.
You know, was she just filler? Because Tom
adding to the jeopardy, I think, adding to the jeopardy. Because I mean, again, the whole point about the kind of going to the island thing is that Tom is on his own, because it's very much like you have the one stranger kind of turning up and trying to figure out what's going on without realizing that everyone is basically against him. And it doesn't work as well with two, I think.
No, and I think that maybe the only reason that she went is so that we could see Martindale's displeasure. I think that was just entirely...
Yeah, well, and at the point that she goes, it does kind of add to the jeopardy. But they keep them apart, and you know, she gets the sequence in the greenhouse or whatever, so they then kind of split them up, so they're each on their own doing their thing, which works. And so I think from the point of view of the structure of the episode, that's right. Maybe we'll get a Tom Light episode if there's an Anne Light episode to balance things up.
I don't think they had that plan in mind back then, but it'd be interesting to see. You probably know more about greenhouses than I do. And the answer is, if you know anything about greenhouses, you know more about greenhouses than I do. This is not really greenhouse territory of the world. Steam? When they started that stuff coming out, I thought that was supposed to be gas. And then they were trying to kill her with gas.
Yes, because she was coughing.
And then they reveal it's steam. Is there a logical reason why you would have a steamer in a greenhouse? Because wouldn't that just cook the plants? Isn't that what we do to make steamed vegetables, is just steam them?
I think when you steam vegetables, it has to do with having quite a lot of steam. Whereas I think the point about a greenhouse is to have a controlled climate, so you control the amount of steam going in. But then normally you would think it would be quite safe to be in the greenhouse, because the controlled, you know, the amount of steam going in would be very minimal, in order that not to damage the plants and thereby, fortunately, not damaging the humans. I don't understand why she's coughing, though. You don't cough when it's steamy. Well,
not
I don't
really.
Cough when it's steamy.
Not much. Yeah, that was part of it. It's like, well, she seems like she's...
The danger is being scalded, not being, you know, asphyxiated.
Which is why she didn't... If it had been steam, I would have thought, even though there was the... I mean, even though there was the grating or the fencing over the glass, she had tools there. She should have been breaking all the glass, right? Whether or not
help.
She could crawl through it, but it would certainly help if it's just steam, because I don't think it's very warm outside on this island, so...
Well, it's Scotland.
Yeah, and it's a little island off of Scotland, so, yeah, that, it, you know, I thought it was gas. I thought she had to break her way out, peel the thing, finally get through the glass, get a door open, and get out before the gas overcame her, which seemed a little like she should have been gone long before she got the door open, and then to have them turn around and go, yeah, somebody tried to steam me. What? I didn't.
Well, maybe she was wrong. But I guess my feeling is that unless it's some kind of special reinforced greenhouse, the idea of there being a lot of jeopardy in shutting someone inside one is a bit...
Hard to believe.
Bit of a hard sell, shall we say.
Okay, good. That was my impression of greenhouses. They just seem like glass houses.
They're not built for security.
Are built for security, right.
Like, not unless they're housing really ferocious plants.
Well, she did. So Blondie did make the lamest threat ever about showing Anne her Venus flytraps. And I listened to that and I was... in my mind trying to go, is that because in the 1970s the perception was that Venus flytraps were actually vicious, dangerous plants with teeth instead of kind of lame
if they were big
traps, yeah. Or was there like a
we don't know what
there.
The psychic energy does. We didn't really see the product of the, well, I suppose we saw it was inside the greenhouse. We don't know, there weren't fields of corn with 8-foot ears outside or whatever, and therefore, you know, the Venus flytraps could be
humans, yeah, right.
20 or 30 times the size of a normal... I don't know.
It was just a very catty line that just...
I thought it was just like, catty rather than a proper threat.
Yeah, but it was still sort of like, I'm going to make a catty line about this water bottle. That's how dangerous I am. I don't know. So in the end, Tom puts the whammy on what is his name? Hob, and causes him to lose control just when he's on his psychic killing spree, because he wants to kill Anne, and they escape, and I'm guessing Hob kills everyone in the room.
Yes, I think that seemed to be what was happening.
Was it... So, one evening in the bar, when they're having a locals' night, just before Terry and the Pirates are going to take the stage... If I ever have a band, I am totally calling it Terry and the Pirates. That is just too good. But we are not wearing those outfits.
I think you have to.
One of the locals is staring at Anne a lot.
Yes.
And he's the one that kicks off the violence.
Yeah.
In the pub. And the owner of the pub, after it's been subdued, complains to Mr. K about once a month one of your people goes berserk in here. So my impression was that the treatment that they're giving these people to keep them under control, whether it's mind control or just suggestive control, eventually stops working and they go berserk. Does that seem like a fair premise?
Yeah.
At the end, it looks like it's Hobbs' time. Is that just coincidence that it happened to be when he's about to go berserk? Or did they push him over the edge to get him ready to kill Tom and Anne? Because he seemed like he might have been a useful operative. And that's the other question is, do they, once they've gone berserk, can they be brought back?
Well, that wasn't clear. I kind of got the impression, well, I don't know.
My impression from the wife at the beginning was that when you go over that point, it's too late.
Yeah.
So it just seemed kind of odd when Hob came in and he's like, I'm here to take you to Mr. K. And Tom's like, well, it looks like you had a snootful. I didn't think you were going to come. Like, what? I'm like, so he's been sitting in the bar drinking because he figured Tom wasn't going to go, so he didn't need to drive? It really was kind of an odd line. And then with the weird editing of this show, next scene, Tom thrown in dungeon. Let's call it dungeon. He doesn't make a good account of himself as the action hero of this story. We don't even know if he put up a fight. Or did Hob just take him and throw him in the room? It's like, here it is, in the room. I don't know. I just, again, weird editing, weird way of telling the story. I guess we
think he knows by then that. I think he knows by then what he's up against.
Do you think he knew he was being locked up and that he was just going along with it?
Well, I think he knew that.
Or he's going to his death. Let's put it that way.
He was outnumbered.
Well, I don't know. Strange episode. Do we have anything else about?
Well, I've got one last complaint that I'm going to get on my soapbox for a minute.
Uh-oh.
And it doesn't just apply to this episode. It kind of harks back to Child's Play, and I gave Child's Play a pass because they did it once. But it's this thing, you know, you're telling a dramatic story. You can have something where your protagonist fulfills the role of seeing some dramatic consequences occurring to someone else who might, you know, they might have a connection with, and that's how we as the audience explore it, because their friend is undergoing this trauma or whatever it is.
I was gonna comment just as I was doing the recap, that Tom's friends appear to be on the same level as Simon Templar's friends.
Right.
If somebody is Simon Templar's friend at the beginning of the episode,
they're dead. Here's the thing with Simon Templar or John Steed or Tom Crane or whoever, where or Fox Mulder, you know, any story where what we've actually got is the drama is being explored by someone who is investigating it, and therefore there is a kind of there's a professional dimension to it. They are going out and because they're a journalist or because they're an FBI agent or because they're some kind of detective or whatever it is, they're going out and looking for these interesting cases, these interesting mysteries. But because maybe, you know, the writers want to kind of show another dimension to our protagonists, they want to kind of expand their emotional life and explore their friends, but they're limited on a budget because they can't just, you know, bring in extra characters without them having a pivotal role in the story. What we end up with is their friends being the mystery or whatever, and it's a pure coincidence that their friends happen to suffer a problem that is connected with whatever they're investigating. So in this case, it's Anne's the son of Anne's friend who is being haunted by a poltergeist, which just happens to be of interest to Department 7,
and
or Tom's friends who have been experimenting on plants and then have been killed in these mysterious and it turns out psychic related circumstances, which again is of interest to Department 7.
And
but the you know that connection is pure coincidence. And when I mean the Avengers is a great example of this, because for ages and ages they were so well crafted, the episodes where I actually thought, you know, there is something terribly coincidental about the way that Kathy is working in this place and then this thing just happens. You know, she happens to be doing this job and then somehow, oh, suddenly Steed is interested in investigating her colleagues or whatever. But actually, by the time the end of the episode comes, you realise that Steed set Kathy or Venus or whoever up in that situation in the first place, and he's been pulling the strings, and there's a damn good reason why all of those things occur. By the time you get to sort of the end of Series 5, you're mowing through Steed and Mrs. Peel's close friends because, you know, they keep turning up. They keep turning out to be bosom buddies who are, you know, absolutely, you know, their childhood chum or their wartime comrade or whatever. But by the end of the episode, they're pretty much bound to be dead or, you know, in some way have their life ruined and be completely traumatized. And it tends to just happen week after week. And it's a trope I hate it. It really, really gets under my skin. I think last week I would have given it a pass because you can do it once. But for it to happen again this week, got to call it out.
It was too much. It was definitely too much in this one. There was...
It's completely unnecessary as well. I mean, that's what annoys me the most.
If they had been friends and he had seen the murder of some friends, then I can see Tom wanting to go investigate. All right, I can follow that. But where I lose it is that then suddenly we come bring this all back to the Omega conspiracy, and it's like that's too much.
But
friends is bad enough, but yeah.
In this particular story, there was some need for Tom to go off investigating something that Martindale didn't want him to investigate, and yet which clearly does have some connection to something Martindale knows about, and maybe the Omega stuff too, we don't know. But it doesn't have to be a friendship of Tom's or whatever. It could actually be something directly related to his job, in the sense that he might have seen the story and spotted something anomalous about it and gone, hey, shouldn't I be investigating this? And told Martindale he should be investigating this, and then got annoyed by the fact that Martindale dismissed his opinion on the matter. And that could have been the reason that he kind of felt, well, in that case, I'm damn well going to go and do it. And that would have been fine.
Right. But yeah, those people were great. Yeah. And a connection to have him.
And it's always
to
the
it,
thing
but,
about these
yeah.
friends are these friends, you've never, ever seen them before the episode in which they turn out to have some hugely coincidental connection to the work of Department 7 or
it wouldn't have been as it wouldn't have been as bad if they had simply been, oh, I did an article on these people and not
Indeed.
Portraying them as
Indeed.
Friends.
Yep. Yep.
It's like, okay, and they were doing psychic-y stuff. So
yeah, and he had been writing a series on psychic-y stuff, so it'd be perfectly plausible that when he'd written the first series, he'd interviewed them as part of that. Yep, fine, you know, it's a kind of unnecessary coincidence that's supposed to add an additional dimension to the characters because, oh, you know, they've lost someone who's very dear to them and so on and so forth.
Like his wife. But,
yeah, well, but episode one, that's the setup. That's where you do this stuff. That's where you do it. But, yeah, not like this. Anyway, small thing, but...
fair enough.
But a
with
common
like three
thing.
Three more episodes.
And,
so how many more friends can Tom have?
Indeed.
Maybe he'll get back to investigating his wife's death.
Well, I hope he managed to do that in at least one episode.
That would be nice. Maybe we get some conclusion on that. Anyway, in the meantime, Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Well done.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Please consider becoming our sponsor at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Search for us on Facebook under Fusion Patrol. Check out our Twitter handle, @FusionPatrol. Or just send us an email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Please come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf. And listeners, I do hope you'll join us again. I'm going to restart that.
Yeah, you do that, listeners.
Yeah.